The Guardian.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
Hello and welcome to Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm Alex Krutowski, and on today's program, we're covering a lot of ground, including information on the most recent products from Google, Microsoft, and Apple. And Apple's been allegedly underpaying its taxes, and details on when the snooping bill will come into force. Also, we're speaking with iGEOLIZE, the folks who are measuring distance using time. And Jemima was at the Decode Festival, and she shares the skinny on the latest marriage between technology and fashion. All coming up on this week's Tech Weekly from The Guardian. I'm joined by Charles Arthur in the studio. Charles, in this week's news, Windows Phone 8. You have a theory that it is targeted at yummy mummies?
Well, there was an interesting segment in the Windows Phone 8 presentation where Joe Belfiore was on the stage, you know, showing off all the features of it. And he got Jessica Alba to come on. Jessica Alba, who's a sort of fairly famous iPhone user who has kids. And they explained how easy it had been to transfer her contacts over onto a Windows Phone 8 device, and she had started using it and she was really enjoying it. And of course, you know, as you'd expect, she was really happy. It was all really great. But I just thought that there are aspects to Windows Phone 8 which really do seem to be targeting the, let us call it, the yummy mummy segment, the sort of, you know, the women who have a job, who have kids, who have a busy life, who need to get things done, who don't want too much hassle. So, for example, there are things like the data monitor, Microsoft will compress the data that you're getting, and it will also provide a data monitor to make sure you don't go over your bandwidth cap for the month. It's got a thing called Kids Corner, where you can, you know, hand over your phone to the kids, but you select the apps which they're going to be able to use, and those will then be, those are sort of safer than to play with. They're not going to be sending text messages and stuff. You know, Jessica Alba had this example of a text, or rather a tweet that one of her kids had sent out, you know, to her million or whatever it is followers. And there are other aspects, you know, such as what they mentioned, the ease of getting porting over from the iPhone, you know, which is quite important, I think, for the US segment there. And general things like Facebook updating, the whole People Hub thing that Windows Phone has been built around. And other aspects such as groups for calendars, groups for sort of messaging, families built in. It's very much, I mean, it is a people-centric device. That's been the way the operating system has always been built. But I get the feeling that with this, they've really thought, who is the group that hasn't really been spoken to yet by smartphone users? Because this is really the third launch for a Windows Phone. They had it back in October 2010, nothing happened. They had it back in October 2011, they said, hey, it's great, it's newer, it's better. Again, nothing happened. And this time, I think they've really thought about bringing out more of those aspects and really focusing on the sorts of people who'll be busy, who want to get things done quickly. And I think that having Jessica Alba there, okay, it's great for eye candy, though the contrast between how tall she is and how tall Joe Belfiore is, because he's not the tallest guy in the world, was actually quite a thing.
So basically you're suggesting that if, you know, they'd had Hulk Hogan in, then it would be a different market that they were targeting.
Well, yeah. 50% of the US adult population does not have a smartphone yet. There's a big potential there. And you can see that a big proportion of them would be people who are, you know, looking to get a, you know, they don't have a smartphone yet, therefore you try to find the one that's most attractive. And equally, they're also saying to people who own iPhones or, you know, perhaps own Android phones, you don't like it, hey, you can switch over quite easily and here's all the things you'll find. I think it's a message which is, if you look at the advertising is quite soft-edged. If you compare Apple's adverts, if you compare the Amazon adverts are very soft-targeted. They're very much aiming at women. They're saying, you know, nice, easy book to read. They're not aggressive. They're not pushing, and they're not flashy. And again, I think with Windows Phone that there's the same sort of feel here, that actually the female demographic is much more the one to go for. That if you compare an ad for Amazon, you compare, you know, ads for Windows Phone with, say, the ads for things like Motorola phones, those are much, you know, the Motorola ones are sort of, they're almost like sort of the most aggressive car adverts. They're sort of, wow, incredible, you know, you're Flash Gordon sort of things. And that's really not what Windows Phone is about.
It's not just Windows Phone 8 that has been released this week. We also saw Google's tablet and Google's latest Nexus phone come on the market. Tell me how those have been received.
The Google Nexus 4 is its latest smartphone. So this is the one which has the Google name on it, although it's been built for it by LG. Pretty much everything about the phone was known before it was launched. And anyway, the actual physical launch, the announcement, was put off because of Hurricane Sandy, or Superstorm Sandy, as I think it's been called.
I think once it hit, people went, maybe we shouldn't be calling it Frankenstorm, because that's giving it too, you know, too light a treatment.
Yeah, so that had to be put off, but Google did sort of announce the fact of it anyway. The Nexus 4 has been criticized in some parts of the US tech press for the fact that it doesn't have LTE. And Google's explanation for this was that because of the way that US carriers work, they don't all use the GSM standard. Instead, you have people like Verizon who use CDMA, which is a non-compatible standard with GSM. So LTE, which is the high-speed mobile broadband, has to be tuned differently for every different carrier. So, for example, if you buy an iPhone 5 on Verizon and then try to take it to AT&T, it won't work. The LTE element of it won't work because it's a CDMA phone. In fact, it won't work on AT&T at all because that's a GSM network.
How will that affect what happens on the ground, though? Will that be things like, you know, third-party providers? Like in this country, we have Carphone Warehouse and other sort of third-party high street distributors of the phones. Will that affect whether or not they'll pick up the phone, or will it just be focused on the carriers?
No, the lack of LTE, I don't think is a huge loss because they got it's got HSPA, so that can be as fast. Certainly in the UK, it's as fast, you know, as LTE can be. It's certainly in the same region. Whereas in the US, HSPA is quite a way behind LTE. It's to do with the way that the carrier build out works, and to do with you know, the amount of effort that's been put into HSPA, which is sort of intermediate between 3G and 4G.
But this isn't a phone killer, is it?
It's not an iPhone killer. The thing about
the LTE issue isn't going to...
The lack of LTE, I think, is really not an issue outside the US. And I don't think it's really an issue outside the US tech press, where people get worked up about, you know, does it have this spec or that spec? And actually, they don't look at what's the phone like to use, which is surely a much bigger issue.
Google's also having some trouble with the U.S. Federal Trade Commission, the FTC. What's happening there?
Bloomberg on Friday was reporting that the FTC staff have passed a file to the FTC commissioners, of whom there are five, who have to decide with a majority verdict before any action is taken or initiated. But the FTC staff are reported to have said that Google should be investigated for antitrust behavior in relation to the patents that it owns. That's actually Google's Motorola subsidiary, MMI, which it completed the acquisition of early this year. MMI has been investigated in Europe as well as coming under investigation in the US because of the lawsuits it's brought against Apple and against Microsoft in particular, where it has what are called standards essential patents. These are standards which are essential for things like Wi-Fi in particular. And the argument is that you can't seek to injunct people if you haven't made proper efforts to license things. And Apple and Microsoft have both been saying that the amount that Motorola has been demanding is too great compared to all the other companies that it licenses these patents to. The argument being that Motorola is trying to prevent Microsoft from using its patents against Motorola and charging it for various infringements relating to Android, and that Apple is trying to take similar actions against Motorola over alleged infringements within Android as well. So this is the way that Motorola fights back. Now that Google owns Motorola, it's fallen under the ambit of the FTC, and the question is whether the commissioners will take this forward and start to initiate an antitrust action against Google's Motorola subsidiary for abusing its standards essential patents.
Well, given the patent rush that we were reporting on earlier this year, do you think that Google was aware that this was in the pipeline, that they knew that they would have to take a hit?
They completely knew that Motorola was being investigated in this way, and they completely knew that the question of what happened with standards essential patents, whether they're freely licensed, whether they are used, whether you seek an injunction first and license afterwards, or whether you try to negotiate and if all else fails, well, you just keep on negotiating and eventually work it out. Which to say, I have to say, is what Nokia did. Nokia sued Apple over standards essential patents sometime back in 2007 or 2008. And that ground on and on and on. But eventually Apple had to yield. And they are paying Nokia something in the order of...
enough to keep them floating, shall we say.
They're certainly paying them a substantial amount. But that was over standards essential patents. The difference being that Nokia didn't try to injunct Apple. They just took it to trial. So yes, Google knew that this was a problem. They wrote to both the FTC and the European Commission ahead of the takeover. And the difference was that whereas Apple and Microsoft, who have got some patents, have said that where they've got them, they'll license them freely, Google's language was a bit more roundabout about how it would use these patents. And that was noticed. And both the EC and the FTC did put Google on notice that they didn't particularly like the way it was talking about this in relation to the takeover of Motorola.
So what can we expect over the coming, I don't know, weeks, months with regards to this case?
Lots more lawyers.
Finally this week, last week, UK Home Secretary Theresa May presented her evidence for the Communications Data Bill in front of a select committee. And the proposed bill has been greatly criticised for the section that opponents are calling the Snooper's Charter, which gives government the right to track all UK-based web traffic. We've discussed that element quite conclusively on this podcast. But Charles, what happened the day Theresa went to the select committee?
Well, she told the select committee that she expects to introduce the legislation later this session and that it will take some while to get through and that it should be on the statute book by 2014. That's just before the next election. And police officers also spoke to the select committee. They said that it's a vital operational tool for monitoring gangs and tackling security threats in a world where, quote, rapidly changing technology meant to the authorities were losing the ability to keep track of criminal suspects. So the worry from the Senate committee is that this collection of data, in particular records of every citizen's web and mobile phone use, it's not the content of the pages, but it would be the sort of header of the pages that you visit, web and mobile phone use, including social networking sites, and store that for 12 months and be able to basically work back through it.
I'd love to see the mountain that they're going to stick those servers in. I'd love, actually love to see the underground bunker where they're going to be putting all of that hard, even just the headers is almost an impossibility, isn't it?
No. I mean, Google does it. Google has something in the order of 200 million users for Gmail.
But is that information in any way useful if all you have is that I visited Twitter, I visited Facebook, I visited LinkedIn? I mean, you don't know who I'm visiting. You don't know what kinds of communications are happening. You don't know the exchange, which is actually the interesting and important thing.
Well, certainly they've said that they're not going to be keeping the content, but I think what they're looking for here is the traces to see if, for example, you email someone and then you both go on Twitter, or you both go on Twitter and then you email someone. I mean, you can vaguely see what the police are aiming at here, but it does smack a bit of the whole farrago over the 90-day detention, where it was argued that the police needed to be able to detain people for 90 days without charge because they would have to do all sorts of incredible, you know, finding terrorist stuff. That was knocked down to 60 days, I think, then 30, then 28, and then 14. And I think it stands at either 14 or 7 at the moment. And there has been no evidence ever brought that a terrorist act has occurred or even not been averted because of the inability to do this. So, you know, the evidence for it is pretty thin, it has to be said.
Now, let's talk a little bit about this timeline. She's proposing that the bill is enacted within the next year and later in this session, as she says, and that it ends up in the statute books by 2014. Is this actually realistic? You mentioned that this would be just before the next election. We saw this similar phenomenon happen with the Digital Economy Act and during the wash-up during the previous election. Are we going to see this again, or are people going to recognize what's happening?
Well, this is the most rebellious parliament there's been for absolutely ages. So there was a defeat of the government only last week over Europe. And you can see that the Liberal Democrats might find some common cause with the Labour Party over this one. I don't think the Labour Party particularly
Sorry,
likes
I don't mean
this.
To laugh. Yes, please continue.
Okay. Well, I don't think that many of the Liberal Democrats would particularly like this. You know, the ones who are not actually in not inside government, so to speak, the ones who are not having to, act rather like the people in the thick of it, which always seems to me the best portrayal of it. And Labour would love to kill this. They'd love to kill a Conservative bill like this. And Nick Clegg, I suspect, is not really going to be entirely in favour of this. I don't think he's been quizzed on this.
He hasn't yet, as far as I'm aware.
So I suspect that it only takes a few Tory MPs to start not liking this, to go along with some Labour MPs and some Lib Dems. Given the arithmetic of it, if enough the Lib Dems rebel, if you get a few Tory MPs rebelling, then the bill is in all sorts of trouble. And add to that the fact that it has to go up through the Lords, even though the Lords are meant not to create problems for a bill, I could see that you might have the situation where this might sort of limp through this session, but then start to go through the ping pong where it goes back and forth between the House of Lords and the House of Commons, and neither side likes what the other has done to it, and it might end up in the wash up, and it might survive or it might die.
Well, the rabble rousing from both sides on this is very interesting. It is described by opponents as the snooping bill, and then in this particular week, the opponents have been suggesting that the database that would be collected could be at the mercy of international hacker rings, or people would be able to get into this database. So we're already starting to see some quite emotive headlines about this that I imagine are intended for public pressure to affect the outcome of whether or not this bill is brought into Parliament.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you listen to some of the things they've been saying, Nick Brown, who's a former Labour minister, former Labour whip, in fact, said the public are frightened they're going to be spied on and the illegally obtained information would find its way to the public domain. Lib Dem peer Lord Strasburger said the proposals were a honeypot for casual hackers and blackmailers. Against that, Theresa May said that the state is not going to be reading your emails. As she said, that there's limited scope for the data we want to have access to. We want to be very clear about that. The police will have to make a very clear case for requesting access to data when there's an investigation that requires it. Though I feel she slightly undermined her point then by saying police made urgent requests for communications data in 30,000 cases last year, and between 25% and 40% of them resulted in lives being saved. To which you think, well, then what's wrong? Where is this not working? I think the problem is that the government is, and the police to some extent, are saying this is terrible and we really need to be on top of this. But they aren't showing us the occasions, possibly because it would be embarrassing, but they're not sort of pointing to examples where they can say, look, this bad thing happened because we weren't able to stop these people in time, because they were using Skype or a VPN or some sort of app that we couldn't monitor. And they're being very vague about what it is they can and can't monitor, because actually All you need is for the bad guys to be using VPNs or to be using Tor or to be using Skype, and the possibility for following what they're doing comes very small.
Well, we will of course be covering this as it moves its way through the We will of course be following this story as it progresses. You can read up on all of the stories this week at guardian.co.uk/technology. Coming up next, we're speaking with Charlie Davies, who is the co-founder of startup Idealized, which is based in Guildford. Now, Charles, tell me a bit about Idealized, because you wrote an article about them this week.
Yeah, they use an idea which has been pinging around for a couple of years, which has also been used by a company called MapuMental, which is one of the My Society startups. But Idealized is completely separate. But it's a similar idea, which is that you might want to measure your journeys rather than measuring them in distance. You'd want to measure them in time. So rather than saying how far away is Hampstead from Balham, rather than being answered in miles, you'd want to know how long does it take to travel there by bus, by car, by tube.
It would depend upon a variety of different transportation options. And so, and Charlie's on the phone at the moment. Thank you very much for joining us, Charlie.
Yeah, my absolute pleasure.
How did Charles do there? Did he get you right?
Yeah, that's fantastic. Yeah,
I think you're going to be you're going to be co-opted into any pitch meetings in the future, there, Charlie.
So, Charlie, tell us. I mean, those are the bones of the idea. You have a website with a few pictures, sort of showing demonstrations. But when could we start to expect to see this on smartphones or being used in websites of companies you might have heard of?
So there are some sites out there that are currently using it. Christian Connection, a dating website, is currently using it so people can find dates within a reasonable travel time of where they are. We've also just released an iPad application that's actually only available in the States at the moment, but that was done through Adobe. So Adobe have just released an application over there.
How does it work? Could you just explain the US application and why it's US?
Sure. Adobe, we saw Adobe when we were over in San Francisco a few months ago. They really liked the product and have implemented it into a showcase restaurant finder. So when you're in San Francisco or New York, where we now have some live data, you can search for restaurants or bars that are within a sensible walking time away from where you are right now.
Have you integrated any other kind of data out there? So you say, you know, you're using it for Christian Connections, you're using it for restaurant finders and various other things. Will you be integrating any other kinds of data, or are you sticking pure with the orological data that you've identified?
So what we didn't want to do was hold location data, so points of interest or anything that the end user then wanted to actually find. What we have is a system where we can define the local area that a user can actually use. So the word local is being used quite a lot, but local really isn't a defined government boundary or a town. But it's what the user can actually get to within the resources that they have. So with their mode of transport and time, the area around them is dictated to by those things. What we do is have a system where anyone else who has that location content, whether it's a bar with all of the reviews or a job or a property, they can easily use our system to start providing much more relevant search results to their users. So we never hold that data, the actual points of interest data. We just allow other people to use our software to make their points of interest much more relevant.
So give us a scenario where, for example, someone would use that iPad app, the one you mentioned, the Adobe one. What's the sort of step-by-step of how someone would use that?
So they would essentially just say, locate me to where I am or perhaps where I'm going to be. I can walk or I can take public transport. I've got 20 minutes, and then very, very quickly in the back end, the search happens on our side, and we would display back the results based on time. So they would see them ranked in order of time.
So in terms of getting the timetables and so on for trains, buses, yep, public transport, and then also figuring out things like cars and so on, that's a big job. How easy has that been to do in the UK?
That's been a very complicated and laborious process. There's lots of data out there, but it's all in different formats with different agreements on how and when you can use it. There are certain things we can do to improve that, but essentially the point we're at now, we have incorporated everything that we can inside the UK. And we've got to a point where it's accurate enough that it is vastly more valuable than searching by the current option, which is only just distance.
And what sort of interest are you getting from, say, you know, high street stores and people?
Lots of interest. A few that I can't really talk about just as when they go live. But we built this, our back-end API, so it could be used by any front-end system. So our options of integration are quite vast. I mean, we do all of the heavy lifting RN. There's no extra resources to have on the front-end application. Just over a simple RESTful API, we can do all the processing. So we're getting lots of interest from lots of retail stores and lots of high street chains.
And I can imagine that if it's open enough, then other people will be able to integrate this into, say, the recommendation services and,
sure.
and various other search
yeah,
options.
Yeah, so the
as
API
well.
Is self-served already. You can go onto our website and gain access to the to API keys and the code examples to get going. Our quickest integration to date was 4 hours, and the Adobe guys managed to do it into an iPad application in about a day. So we've tried to make that as quick and possible for developers to start using it.
And where did you get the idea? What sort of first triggered the thought that what actually matters in travel is not distance but time?
In terms of we were trying to understand how and why people actually use location data.
When was this roughly?
When Idealize started, we actually wanted to produce a consumer-facing offering, whereas now we're exclusively business-to-business. But we found that there was actually lots and lots of content out there, and keeping the content up to date is a very hard thing to do, and there's lots of people competing in that area. But everyone was serving the content in exactly the same way. So it was, where are you? What's your distance? What county are you in? What postcode, etc. So we just took one step back and just tried to figure out, well, when people actually search for local content, they're going to want to go there. So it should probably be ranked by time and not by distance, dependent on what the user can actually do.
Was there a sort of aha moment when you suddenly realized that was the key thing?
Yeah, I was actually driving my own car down in the New Forest and was going through a series of different types of roads, from motorways to A roads to very narrow, windy back roads. And then to me, it was just all about the time this journey was taking. It wasn't, you know, the distance of locations around me.
Local search and local functionality is a really interesting, relatively new approach online, because people have often thought, you know, I'm going to go online, I'm going to go global, I'm going to go worldwide as quickly as possible and be as accessible to the world as I can be. Tell me a little bit about the local search, the local services community in the UK.
Well, it's incredibly busy, and there's lots of people competing on, I would say, different data sets and the amount of value they can wrap around the different data sets. So, for example, there's lots of people who list different restaurant areas or properties or jobs, and we've recently seen that lots of property sites will actually be molded into one with the Zoopla acquisitions. But in terms, I would say that there's lots of competition on the content, but I mean, that's what the conclusion we came to was that competing on the content, there's just too many people in that space at the moment, and what we thought would be better is actually trying to resort and make the data that they already have much more relevant to their users. So it's an incredibly busy and hot space and quite an exciting one to be in.
You said that there's lots of competitors in this space. I mean, I suppose one would have to wonder whether, you know, the three big smartphone players of Google and Nokia with Navtech and Apple, now that they've got a mapping service, are those the sort of competitors you're thinking about, or are there others? And where do you see those smartphone providers in this landscape?
Well, all the smartphone providers are very heavily trying to acquire and keep all of their own mapping data, which is great, because any competition like that will just drive innovation on all sides. In terms of, you know, let's say we want to try and find a restaurant, the de facto standard might be going into Google, but there's hundreds of other sites trying to do restaurant locations and or property locations or job locations. And a lot of this data is repeated among different sites or applications. So there is a heavy amount of competition in the local space. It also seems at the moment a bit of a buzzword in terms of, you know, local. So everything can be local. But, you know, just trying to define what local is and what location is not as simple as just saying, you know, the blue dot on a map.
So, Charlie, what's the next step for you as a company?
Well, we're going live with some bigger clients throughout the UK, and then rapidly rolling into the rest of Europe and the United States as quickly as we can move.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Charlie Davies, the co-founder of IGLIZE. Next up in Tech Weekly, we hear from The Guardian's digital media correspondent, Jemima Kish, who went to Decoded Fashion last week, a pitching event for startups creating services for the fashion industry. Apologies, by the way, for some of the audio quality. Here's Jemima.
I'm watching a video featuring three people I have to admit I've never heard of. The interesting thing about this video is that it's interactive. You can see the guy sitting on a crate. And you can shop this look, as it says. You can click on interactive tags that run along through the video and then click through to buy what he's wearing. So this will be very familiar to people from Facebook. This is the basic principle of tagging stuff. I'm with Dan Garraway from Wirewax, the company that has developed this technology. Dan, tell us how this came about and how long you've been doing it.
Yeah, so we basically came from production background. We were actually producing a lot of the content for short form online. So we were talking to people like Clairol and makeup and beauty clients like that who were making this video content. And what they wanted to do was make it so people could actually click and touch on the products that were being featured and buy them. It's the most simple sort of explanation of that, really. And Wirewax started to be born out of that, and we came from an engineering background as well. And it formed into what we have here. So this is a moving hotspot, which will motion track the people and objects in video. Of course, the people and objects move in video, so that's important, that what you click on is exactly what you actually touched or clicked in the video. When you click, it then presents anything that you want it to. In the example we're seeing here, we've got product information about what this particular girl, this Iggy Azalea girl, is actually wearing. So I could buy what she's wearing. There are other use cases in entertainment, such as clicking on actors, seeing actors like this, or seeing character profiles in a sitcom, maybe.
And in fashion, what's the response been from retailers? Because this, obviously, could be big bucks for them.
Yeah, absolutely. One of the strongest use cases was very early on a niche fashion retailer in East London called Oki Nee. And they produced a video with Ridley Scott Associates. And they were one of the first to prove the e-commerce use case in fashion. They got a 58% click-through rate from the video through to the product page. And they converted $20,000 worth of revenue out of that video directly in 2 weeks. So it made a huge difference to their metrics. And ongoing from that, we had Nike and Tommy Hilfiger and Rip Curl, many of those top-tier brands signing up and becoming regular users. And that's really what it's all about. We're not about making a product which people use once and again. We're about something that people can fundamentally use in their everyday, making a tangible contribution towards their direct revenues, but also engagement of their audiences.
And the second use case for this, given that people are very familiar with the principle of tagging, is for kind of individual consumers. So are we going to see this on Facebook anytime soon?
Yeah, well, that's certainly the intention. We when you upload a video to Wirewax, of which it's free, if anyone wants to do that, it's wirewax.com, you can upload a video. It will automatically detect the faces in the video. The next stage we're rolling out just at this very moment in time is recognition of those faces, so we can identify your friends in the video. And then we can also identify famous people, perhaps politicians, if you want to find out who the politician is, I don't know, but you can basically link the intelligence of the web around the video into the video itself. So we're about making the people and the objects in video become part of the web again, like the href, if you like, of what documents have, but for the video itself, for the people and the objects in the video.
So are you based in London?
We are based in London, the whole technology was born and bred here. We actually have a base developing in the US because our sales have just overtaken the US. So it's sort of a bridge in the two sides of the pond at the moment.
And you've got 10 staff, I know. So what happens next?
Well, really, it's about building the brand and making sure that everyone knows about us, because one of the things is when everybody sees the products, they're really overtaken by it, and they can see an application for it. So we need to let as many people know about it as we can. And then secondly, what you were referring to there about the Facebook integration side, the use case for the user-gen audience is interesting for us. So we're concentrating a lot of resources into the computer vision side, which is where we can make the video intelligent. That's the grand theme here, to make video intelligent part of the web.
Jemima Kish with Dan Garraway from Wirewax. That's it for this week. Thanks to Charles Arthur for being in the studio and Charlie Davies for joining us down the line. I'm Alex Kratosky. The producer of Tech Weekly is Jason Phipps. We're back next Tuesday with all the latest headlines. Do join us then. Thanks for listening.
Guardian Holiday Offers is pleased to bring you a great selection of worldwide trips from our trusted partners. From cultural tours and adventure holidays to river cruises and cottage breaks, we have something for everyone. To find your perfect break, go to guardian.co.uk/travel with us. That's guardian.co.uk/travel with us.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.